Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Publishers Weekly says Kelly Braffett's new novel, Save Yourself, is captivating and realistically creepy, adding that she uses graceful prose, astute dialogue, and vivid characters to carry the plot to an unexpected and believable finale. Save Yourself is a layered tale of a group of characters, each seeking their own warped version of peace. Braffett's previous works include the novels Josie and Jack and Last Seen Leaving, and her writing has been published in the Fairy Tale Review, Post Road, and several anthologies. We welcome Kelly Braffett to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
A delight to have you on the program. At what point did you come to, I guess, was there a particular, something in particular that you wanted to accomplish with this novel?
Well, actually, the absolutely honest answer is yes, because I had promised a friend a short story and didn't have an idea for one. And so the thing that I most wanted to accomplish with the germ of this novel was to write a short story and so my friend wouldn't be mad at me. And I locked myself in my office for a weekend and basically hacked and hacked and hacked at it. And the short story itself was fine, but it had these three characters in it that sort of stuck with me. The three, you know, Mike and Caro and Patrick, the two brothers and the girlfriend. But additionally, with my previous novel, Last Seen Leaving, I did a book group in Western Pennsylvania. And the novel, that novel is about a woman who's sort of a New Age philosophy adherent, lots of crystals and so forth. And the women in that particular book group, it just happened to be all women, really at the end of the book, several things happened with that book. The first was that a couple of the reviews talked about it as being, talked about my writing about the New Age aspects of that book as being satiric, which was not at all my intention. I really wanted to convey it as being very sort of earnest and something that this woman truly believed. And then in the book club, there was actually a woman who protested quite loudly that neither of the characters in my book had any faith. And I thought, well, of course they don't have any faith. It never occurred to me to give them any faith. That never popped into my head that they might be religious people. And it sort of stuck with me as something that I wanted to try writing about at some point, that I wanted to try and write a character from the point of view of somebody with a great deal of faith. So when I found myself with these three characters, the two brothers and their girlfriend, who have pretty much no faith in anything in various ways, I thought it would be really interesting to sort of mush them together with a family that is basically built around faith and structured around faith, and see what happened.
I want to talk about the book specifically in just a moment, but before we let this go, of the effect of readers and reviews. Of course, many writers come here and they talk to us about their books and they say, I never read reviews because that would have an effect and so forth. I would think for a young writer specifically, particularly, that it would be very helpful to have that guidance or not.
Well, it depends on the review. Obviously, there are some reviews that you sort of don't want in your head. But I find that after the book has been out for a while and you sort of get a little emotional distance from it and from the fact that it's being read and being commented on, that, yeah, there definitely are things that I've read in reviews that I've thought, not that I've taken them in the same way that I would take a critique in a writing workshop or something, but they have sort of stuck in my head, and I've thought, oh, that's interesting. I should think about that.
Of how it is perceived by others, which is what you'd get from a book group as well.
Exactly, yeah. How it's perceived by others, things that other people see in it or don't see in it that I don't see. I really like interacting with readers because it's you sort of see the book through this funhouse mirror. And people always see things in it that you don't expect. And the same is true for reviewers.
The novel is written in alternating voices of Patrick and Verna. What was it about these two characters to kind of head the game, if you will?
Well, Patrick was always in my head. Poor Patrick. Patrick is he's a smart person who grew up in a not particularly smart world. where being smart wasn't particularly valued. And he has this mixture of sort of vulnerability and defensiveness. And he's also, at the beginning of the book takes place about a year after Patrick's father is convicted of killing a child in a drunken hit and run. And that has really had a profound effect on Patrick. Not just his sense of his father's guilt, but his sense of his own sort of complicity every time he let his father get behind the wheel drunk. And I thought that was really interesting, the sort of exploration of how grief and sort of social opprobrium kind of combine and mesh, and how that can really break a person's life apart. And as for Verna, Verna's actually the younger sister of Layla, who in some ways is one of the central figures of the novel. But I knew from the beginning that I couldn't write about Layla because it was too close. Verna, we need a little bit of distance on her. Writing from Layla's perspective would really have given too much away too soon. With Verna, she sort of serves the role of, you know, the person from the ordinary world who gets sucked into the fantasy realm, who has to learn about it as she goes. And with Verna, we get that same sort of, you know, education in Layla's world slowly and surely as the book progresses.
I was fascinated by the beginning of the novel in that these characters are really in a position of paying a very heavy price for what their parents did, for the choices that their parents made.
All of them are, really.
Yes. Yeah. And that's an interesting thing to consider, of the baggage that you have, because it's not a baseline that they're starting at.
No, I mean, everybody to a certain extent carries that baggage with them. Everybody to a certain extent does, you know, find themselves dealing with long-term choices that their parents made for them, in one sense or another. With the case of the Elshier sisters, who are Layla and Verna, and the Cusimano brothers, Mike and Patrick, they're dealing with much more short-term choices. In Patrick's case, it's his father's sort of inability to cope with his mother's death and his decision to drive after having far too much to drink. And right. In the case of the Elshier sisters, it's their father's sort of political involvement in this brouhaha that happens in school, where he hears from Layla that there's a biology teacher who gave a very basic sex ed demonstration and takes it to the school board, and it sort of blows up. And he doesn't ever really consider the effect that it has on his daughters, who have to go to that school and spend 8 hours a day in that school. And I think that, like I said, I think that we're all sort of dealing with those choices, but I also think that there's, no matter who we are and no matter how far we come, I think we always sort of carry our parents with us. And I feel like that's a little bit of a faux-wise thing to say, because it's a little bit obvious in some ways.
Well, it is. But in this case, in this dramatic case, when you look at Patrick, there's such shame and alienation as a result of the choices. I mean, it's different than having your parents be in the armed forces and bringing you from one place to another and being an army brat versus having them be felons.
Sure, sure. And there's also a sense where we're not really sure how much of the sort of social censure that Patrick senses is real and how much of it is his own guilt. And there's a moment in the book where his brother says to him, you know, it's not everybody else, it's you. You look at people like, I think the exact line is, you look at everybody like they're about to stab you in the brain. And so there is a sense that the world actually might be a much more forgiving place than Patrick thinks it is, but he himself just can't get there. He can't see that.
And it brings up something in one of the ideas of the novel that I find interesting, because there's so many of us who are given this position, and then, okay, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to fight and become a different person than our parents and say, we do not want to become that, or mirror it in such a way that we become a carbon copy?
That very much does come through. I mean, I think that, you know, your parents' expectations of you in one way or another will drive who you are. And You know, in Patrick's case, his parents had almost no expectations of him, and he has no expectations of himself. And on the other hand, we have Verna, whose parents have such powerful expectations of her that she's never really even considered until the events in this book that she might be able to do anything other than fulfill those expectations. It just hasn't entered her very young mind.
What brought you to Ratchetburg, Pennsylvania?
Ratchetburg is actually a town that I've written about before. My first novel was set also in western Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up, but it was set in a town called Janesville. And when I wrote my second book, which was a bit grittier, I decided that Janesville was too classy. So I made up this town called Ratchetburg, and I originally wanted to call it Mechanicsburg, but there are like four Mechanicsburgs in Pennsylvania, actually. There's several of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked Ratchetburg because it had that sort of toolbox kind of feeling to it. And it's sort of an amalgam of the town where I grew up. I like to write about fictional places because I'm not bound to geography. If I need there to be, you know, two convenience stores and one of them is wonderful and one of them is crappy, then I can do that. But western Pennsylvania, like I said, is where I grew up. And it's a very, I don't want to say it's a strange place because that will make nobody talk to me anymore who lives there. But it is sort of a unique place in that it has a great deal of deeply rooted history, which I suppose most places do. But in western Pennsylvania, that history is so deeply rooted in the industry of the place, in coal mining and steel mills and these industries that for the most part have faded. I actually worked at a warehouse like the one that Patrick works in, and I worked with former coal miners, people who had actually spent 20 years in the mines. And so there's this sense of a glory that's no longer there, or a purpose that's no longer there. And it's also a place that people don't tend to leave that often. I think my generation is leaving a bit more for economic reasons. But it was not at all uncommon when I was growing up there to have friends who lived on the same street as their grandparents. So it's a very sort of enclosed feeling place.
But there was always the wish to get out, that maybe you could be the kid that could get out.
Well, I actually came from somewhere else, which made a big difference. I moved to western Pennsylvania when I was 10 from Arizona. So I came with a sense of mobility and
right.
a sense of other places.
But the kids that grow up in that environment from that, I'm thinking of like the All the Right Moves, Tom Cruise type of Pennsylvania where you're working there and you're just trying for that one shot to get the hell out of the town.
The Flashdance Pennsylvania.
Right.
Yeah. And I think I was actually thinking about that on the way up. I, you know, as social media has sort of grown, I've gotten back in touch with a lot of people that I did go to high school with, and a good number of them left, but a good number of them stayed. And I think that they would say that they are totally happy to live in western Pennsylvania and, you know, root for the Stillers and do their black and gold terrible towel thing. And probably there are just as many of those as the ones who sort of from the beginning, you know, or at least from a very early age, wanted to see what else was out there. I think it varies from person to person. Like, look at the, you know, talking about the brothers in the book, I think that Patrick is somebody who, in another life, you know, had he grown up in another family that was a little bit more functional, would have desperately wanted to get out. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's ever occurred to Mike that, you know, why would you want to leave? You've got everything you need right here.
Kelly Breffett's new novel is Save Yourself. It is published by Crown. When you think about place, is it wanting to explore it for even for yourself to kind of come to terms with it, to understand it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was a teenager, if you'd asked me if I was going to write about western Pennsylvania when I grew up, I would have said, absolutely not. Why would I write about this place? Nothing ever happens here. There's nothing to say. But of course, it's all, you know, for the most part, it's all I've ever written about. And I think that, you know, this book in particular was sort of, was exactly that. It was me wanting to explore not just sort of the economic place that I came from, but also the social place that I came from and how all of these people would live when immersed in that life. I mean, being people, characters who are stuck tend to be sort of a big theme with me. I keep writing about characters who are stuck in one way or another. And the characters in this book are stuck in sort of, they're stuck in geography, they're stuck in their economics, they're stuck, you know, career-wise, if you can call working at a convenience store a career, which I suppose people do.
And putting those characters in a place like that Go-Mart, and putting characters in a place as simple as a loading dock at the high school where they can smoke and talk is fascinating, because it is just, it is stuck in the career and the world sense, but also even in that moment of just sort of being stuck and wallowing in what it is they're feeling and living.
Well, they all spend a lot of time in places that people pass through.
Right.
Patrick, I think a lot of the germ for Patrick and his convenience store job was that the convenience store that I used to get my gas at in Western Pennsylvania, I went in one summer after I had left for college, and the kid working behind the counter was actually a guy that I'd gone to high school with, who was a couple of years younger than me, and who I'd always thought was really good looking and really cool. And so I bought my gas, and I, you know, paid with my credit card, and I think the bill probably went to my dad still at that point, and left thinking, wow, what's his life like now? You know, he had been out of school, and he was spending all of his time standing in this convenience store, and he was a smart guy. So it was, I think that really stuck with me, that notion that, you know, somebody that I thought was smart and cool and good looking was standing behind this counter selling me gas and everybody else gas who was passing through. And, you know, the places that the kids tend to hang out, the loading dock, even Eric's father's apartment, they're not places where you stay. They're places that people sort of tend to move in and out of. The other narrator, she only has a couple of sections, is Caro, and she's a waitress, which is another place that, you know, you don't really think about the interior life of the woman who's bringing you your fish.
You pass through.
You pass through.
Is this the type of book that you always, as you said, you would have never imagined yourself writing about Western Pennsylvania? Is this the type of novel that you had always imagined yourself writing? That thriller novel?
Oh, I think when I was 16, I probably thought I was going to grow up and write The Great American, you know, The New East of Eden or something like that. But when I was in late college, sort of early grad school, I actually discovered classic crime novels. I read a lot of Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and James M. Cain and all of these sort of old pulp writers. And I've always been such a huge story fan. And I think that was sort of what I was running up into in my studies of, you know, capital L literary writing, was that while my writing needs were being satisfied and my pretty word needs were being satisfied, my story needs weren't really being satisfied at that point. And this was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, and I think the literary world has changed a lot since then. But when I discovered these old pulp detective novels, then I think it sort of became inevitable that I was going to write something more like that, something more along the lines of a James M. Cain than John Steinbeck. Fortunately or unfortunately.
and you were a fan of the man who would become your father-in-law, Stephen King.
I was. Speaking of story crafters, he's a master at it.
And also what is fascinating to me about his career, having interviewed him on this program, is that transformation from someone who could be a commercially successful fiction writer, nobody bigger, and to look at what now is considered to be a literary novelist.
Yeah, he has amassed a great deal of cred over the years. And I think that some of that is the changing, like I said, there has been sort of a shift, I think, to novels where things happen. But also, I think he's just a damn talented writer. And I think that, you know, enough people sort of are of age now who grew up on him that they can recognize that he's a damn talented writer. And, you know, as time passes, I think that the focus of his books has changed slightly from, you know, haunted cars to, well, from haunted cars to towns trapped under domes and haunted cell phones. So maybe not, but.
Well, there's such an imaginative quality. And in reading Save Yourself, you get so immersed with these characters. And to you, was there a, go I even shudder asking this, but, you know, is there kind of like a, you know, a Team Patrick kind of mentality, right? You know, Team Edward versus where you think of people who will root for different people at different times.
You mean Team Patrick versus Team Mike?
Yeah.
Boy, I hope so. You know, a question that came up a lot when I was showing the book around before publication, you mm-hmm. know, various editors and my agent and various early readers, was that the characters weren't explicitly likable, which I always found sort of baffling because I've always found Patrick likable. I find his sort of frailty and poor decisions likable.
Well, I find him likable.
Well, good.
And almost, you know, very, that I know this guy.
Yeah. Well, and that's what
relatable.
I wanted. Yes, that's what I wanted people to think. That I do feel like everybody has known somebody like Patrick. Somebody, and I don't necessarily, you know, I think he would be a frustrating friend to have. Mm-hmm. I think he would be profoundly, you know, I've had friends like this that, you know, you sense the potential in them and you just want them to do something, anything. But, I have to say they are some of my favorite characters that I've ever written. I don't think that any of the characters in my other book have stuck with me in quite the same way that this batch has, for whatever reason.
There is a concrete nature to them, a very set, beautiful makeup that they seem to have.
Well, they feel very real to me. And it takes a very long time to write a book.
Sure.
And this one took me 5 years. And I'm not sick of them yet, which I think
that's good.
Is a good thing because I have to spend another year with them while I'm promoting the book. But which is also good because I think it says something about them and my relationship to them. Right. And I think that did help sort of. I think that I captured something in them that was concrete.
I've spoken to many novelists who have said that is their arbiter. If they're halfway through a book and they're sick of the characters, then it goes in the drawer because it's the multifaceted nature of those characters that keep them interesting and fresh and something that they want to be with for an extended period of time.
Oh, absolutely. And I still feel like I could write more about Patrick and Caro. I feel like they have more stories to tell. I mean, eventually you do sort of come up against the wall of how many exciting things can really happen to two people in the span of a lifetime. But at least exciting on the level that, you know, happens to them in this book. There's lots of exciting things that happen.
There are a lot of exciting things. But it's what we expect as readers, too. We want all of those exciting things.
Yes.
And we may even want them from these characters.
That's, hopefully. That's my hope.
Would you write a series?
Would I write a series? I might write a sequel to this one. The fact that Patrick and Caro are still... This sounds a little bit more ethereal than I generally like to be about writing, but the fact that they're still hanging around in my head makes me think that there might actually be a story to tell about them. That happened with the original short story, is I finished it and then they sort of kept thinking about them. So maybe there's more to say there. I don't know if I could write a series in the traditional sense of the series. Oh, gosh, what's a good example of a series? The only one that's coming to mind right now is Jim Butcher's Dresden Files, for reasons that I can't quite figure out, where the magician with the hockey stick fights demons.
Well, you Dennis Lehane series, or Spencer,
right,
or Robert
right.
B. Parker, or something like that.
Something like that, right,
yeah.
Where there's sort of more of a tonal continuity, or even the Larry McMurtry books.
Yes, Lonesome Dove and those, right, where you've set a place and not particularly a sleuth, if you will.
Right.
The new novel is Save Yourself. It is published by Crown. Kelly Braffett, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world. This is a beautiful novel. Thank you very much for sharing it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Joe. This was really enjoyable.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.